What we're going to be doing as we look through these next bits is really just to investigate, to explore our vision and values a little bit more, things that we talked about towards the end of last year, and just to explore them a bit. So we put out there four cultural values, things that we want to see more of. And I guess as we look through 2018, we go, well, do you know what, these four things are probably the underpinnings of what we want to see more of in our church, which is challenge and growth. It means challenge and growth for us as individuals and challenge and growth for us as a church. Another one is inclusive hospitality. Another one is loving service. And the last one is community in action. These are four kind of phrases that try and capture a cultural thing that we want to see increased over this year. And so over these next few weeks, sorry, someone's just walked in the door who I don't think should be coming in.
I think it's the kids.
Is it coming out? Is it? Okay. Sorry. And so over these next weeks, just to want to explore that a little bit, and I want to kick off this morning exploring challenge and growth. I said last week, I think, we're continuing with our midweek groups looking at that shaped material. Certainly we kicked off again on Tuesday with a night of hilarity and randomness and honesty and God speaking and all sorts of things like that. But we had a good evening. But the part of the goal of looking at that shape material is also saying to us, what's God put in our lives? What's he put in our hearts? How has he gifted us? And what's he calling us to do? And the application for that is for the whole of our life, what we're doing at work and home and neighbourhoods and friends and family. Who are we in those things? Are we being and doing all that God's called us to do in all of those settings? But also for us as a church, how do we express the combination of all that God's invested in us, of the people in this room, and particularly one way to express that is that we want to be starting these groups where we're looking at things that God's put on our hearts as individuals, and that we can have a group around that and go, I'm thinking biking at the moment. That's really why I'm going. I think we need a group around biking. But what, for example, so that's where what are our passions? What are we interested in? Liz is still talking about a group around prayer and what it means to pray for neighbourhoods and towns and such like. So there's what we look after. We're after capturing what's in our heart, both our interests and all the stuff that God's calling us to, and how can we express that together and support each other and generally have fun in the process. And so the other kind of relational triangle that's coming into that is this idea of up, in, out. So if you remember when we talked about what these groups are, with the question is, how are they expressing up, which is our relationship to God? How is this group particularly helping us to connect with God? In, how is it building us together as a relational group in honesty and growth together? And out, and this is particularly the one that we know that we want to push into more. How can this group connect us with the people around and the people in this town? So, again, that's where we're going over this year as we look at both what we're doing on the Sundays and as we go mid-week. So, challenge and growth. I think we want challenge and growth in those three areas that I just mentioned, up, in, and out. And we mentioned last week about how growing in our relationship to God is a crucial thing. Changes everything. And as we look for this year, we want to grow in that area and grow in our relationships together and grow in our connections to people outside of ourselves. One of the ways, by the way, to grow in our relationship with God is to read the Bible. I'm just going to keep saying that. It's a great way. I don't know how you do that. I don't know if you've thought about starting a plan, a Bible reading plan this year. I know in previous years people have done followed a Bible in the year plan. It's a great thing to do if you've not done that, particularly if you've not read through the Bible. I'd recommend it. That Bible app. Is it Gate? No, it's not Bible Gateway, is it? What's it called?
YouVersion.
YouVersion, thank you. Does some brilliant Bible reading programs. Just wanted to put that out there again today.
You're really good at the manhouse as well.
Oh, do you?
Bible through the year.
I'm sure you do. but there's great ways of because I guess the question for me always is when you think about reading the Bible is, in that moment where you go, oh, I could read the Bible now, if you haven't set aside a slot to do it, you go, oh, I could read the Bible now and I've got my phone with me, do you know what you'd read? It's a simple question. And the good beauty of a Bible reading plan is to go, oh, I've got a moment, I want to read the Bible, and I know what I'm going to do. Do you know what I mean? And so I've had times in my life where I've not been clear about that, and actually I go, do you know, I really want to read the Bible, but it's a big book. And where on earth do I start? What do I do? So you might, I would just recommend to you that you have a plan on the go. And whether that's something you do in a particular slot, a kind of devotional slot, or whether that's something you just do as you happen to be, I don't know, sitting on a train or waiting in the doctor's surgery, or, you know, you have those moments in time and you go, I'm going to do something, I've got my phone with me and I've got my app. Then you can do that, can't you? And you can let the Bible feed into your life. I just want to recommend that to you. What I do, this links in the end with what I'm, the passage I'm going to, I'm not like this is the big build-up. What I do is I read a passage of the Bible, and actually I slow it down. So actually I don't do Bible in the year. I haven't done the last few years. I work through a book, and I read a short passage, maybe between 5 and 10 verses, and I stop, and I just ask God, what out of this passage speaks to me today? So that's how I do it. It's helpful for me to slow down when I'm reading. I find that when I'm doing a read the Bible in the year, I speed up. And I feel like God often says to me, I want to slow down. And do you know what I mean by that? And settle into the presence of God. And so this helps me to slow down and go, I'm just reading this passage, and I wonder what God speaks to me today. So in December, I started reading the book of Matthew. And I decided to read through these passages asking this question. How does this passage help me in my discipleship? What does it tell me about discipleship for me? So I decided that that's what I'm doing as I read through my little passage out of Matthew every day, or almost every day. And so I thought this was a great plan. And then I opened up Matthew 1. Some of you know the beginning of Matthew 1, and if you don't know, you might want to look at it. Matthew 1 starts with a whole pile of names. In fact, there are 16 verses of names. Do you know this? And it's called the genealogy. And then what it's doing is telling the story, the generational story from Abraham through generation after generation after generation after generation after generation, all the way down to Joseph and therefore to Jesus. Here's a great devotional moment. I'm reading these verses going, okay, now this is a challenge. I wonder what God wants to speak to me through this. Or maybe I'll just skip on, which is probably what I've done historically. But I ask this question of the genealogy. Do you want me to read it? I'm going to read it in a shortened form. It's Matthew 1, and I'm not going to read 1 to 16, because I can't pronounce all the names, probably. 1:1, a record of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. So he starts at the front of what he's trying to do, isn't he? Jesus, son of David, son of Abraham. It starts with this. Abraham was the father of Isaac. Isaac, the father of Jacob. Jacob, the father of Judah and his brothers. Judah, the father of Perez and Zerah, whose mother was Tamar. Perez, the father of Hezron. Hezron, the father of Ram. Ram, the father of Aminadab. Aminadab, the father of Nashon. Poor, struggling. Nashon, the father of Salmon. Let's just talk about him for a moment. Slippery character. Salmon, the father of Boaz. whose mother was Rahab. Boaz, the father of Obed, whose mother was Ruth. Obed, the father of Jesse, and Jesse, the father of King David. One more. David, the father of Solomon, whose mother had been Uriah's wife. Solomon, the father of etc. Let me just read the last one. Just pretend I've read the rest. 16. And Jacob, the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary, of whom was born Jesus, who is called the Christ. And 17. There were 14 generations in all, from Abraham to David. 14 from David to the exile to Babylon, and 14 from the exile to the Christ. So I don't know, maybe you have been in more enlightened churches than I have, but I've never heard anyone speak on this passage before. And I was asking this question, what does this tell me about discipleship? And I'm sure the Spirit of God is working you maybe more than me, and you're immediately spotting all the ways in which the Spirit of God, speaks about discipleship. But as I actually kind of stopped and slowed down and heard God in this, I did feel like he spoke to me. And what struck me is that the beginnings of discipleship, the beginnings of challenge and growth, starts in God's faithfulness and in his grace. And the root of anything that we reach for in God, the start of it all, starts with God. What he is doing in the generations. Do you know what? God's purpose in history is bigger than me, and bigger than you, and bigger than us. His purpose in history transcends the generations. But equally, God is gracious to incorporate us into his purpose and plans. That's good news, isn't it? But there's other things in here as well. Because there are particular names that stand out. One's obviously that we know well. But actually there's five names in there, five names in there that are surprising that they're in there. And it is the names of five women. This is surprising because genealogies are the sort of thing that people wrote in those days. This is kind of standard form in that sense. But it is incredibly unusual to have women in the genealogy. That's just not what they did in those days. Obviously, women, as you know, and this isn't a biology lesson, are essential to the process. However, the credit, the naming, comes through the male line. And so it's incredibly surprising to read in this passage that there are names of four women. In fact, there are five women, because we include Mary at the end, but I've kind of, the ones I've looked at, the four in the Old Testament. And there are four women, one called Tamar, one called Rahab, one called Ruth, and one called Uriah's wife, who we know to be Bathsheba. These women have common things about them. They're common because they should not be in the list. But God, and his purpose and his plans, decided that they should be. They're common in that they shouldn't be in the list for a number of reasons. One is that they are Gentiles. All four of them are Gentiles. They're not part of the Jewish line. This is surprising because the whole point of this story is to describe the Jewish line. And Matthew, right at the front, is making the point that all through history, God was doing more than just Israel. His purpose was always for the whole world. And that's what Jesus came to do. But also because these women all had very good reasons why they would think that they should be excluded from the purposes of God. And what I'm going to do in just in the next few minutes is to talk about why those four women should be excluded and why somehow God is more gracious to them than they would have thought they should be. The point being that there are many ways that we can feel excluded from the purposes of God. Things that we exclude ourselves and we think because of this, that or the other, I am not in. I'm not part of it, and really God should move on to the next person. But God in his grace does not do that. And this is what this genealogy spoke to me about. That through God's faithfulness and his grace, he includes each one of us into his grand purposes in history. And even though those purposes are bigger than us, they include us. Is that okay so far? Mm-hmm. Are you with me?
Yeah.
So what are these kind of four ways that we could possibly feel excluded from the purposes of God that this genealogy tells us we shouldn't be? The first one is the story of Tamar. I should say these stories, all of them pretty much, would make for a fairly ripe TV show. It would be on Netflix or something like that, and it would be an 18 or more. So these stories are make for intriguing reading, shall we say. So I'm going to summarise and describe. First one is a lady called Tamar. Tamar was the wife of one of Judah's sons, Judah being one of the tribes of Israel, you know, one of the kind of patriarchs. And Tamar, her husband, died before she had children. The Jewish law was that the brother should take on the wife of a dead brother when she has no offspring. in order to provide her an inheritance, to provide her for a future. What happened to Tamar was that she was manipulated, excluded, and sidelined by Judah. Judah basically said, he promised her a brother, as it should be. The brother didn't fulfill his duties in order to provide her a child. In the end, Judah said, well, why don't you just go home to your dad? Judah had a responsibility under the law of God to help this woman have an inheritance in him. And he sidelined her. He pushed her aside and said, what should be yours isn't going to happen, basically. He manipulated it, he lied, he cheated, and he pushed her to one side. She looked like she was sidelined from the purposes of God. What was due to her under God's promise to her was denied her. However, she knew what she was due. She knew, let me put it in this language, what she was promised. And that she was promised an inheritance in God. And therefore, she was cunning and clever and exposed the lies of these men who manipulated her life. Do you know what? We can feel like we have been sidelined in the kingdom of heaven. We might have had hopes and dreams, things that we feel like God has put on our hearts as to how things would work out, and they haven't done that. And it might even be because other people have sidelined us, pushed us to one side. And it might therefore be a reason why we think, you know what, we are not part of God's great story. We're not incorporated into God's good plan. The story of Tamar, and the reason she is on this list is because God says, you are not sidelined in my purposes. You are not pushed to one side. The promises that I've spoken over your life will in fact be fulfilled. And the thing about Tamar is that she was not going to let it rest. She was a fighter for what God had spoken over her life. I believe that is a reason why she's included in this list. She said, I know what I'm due, and I'm going to pursue it in God. And today, if you feel like sidelined, I encourage you to pursue God for the purposes that he has of your life, the promises that you feel he has spoken. That's Tamar. The second one is Rahab. Rahab was a prostitute in Jericho. We know the story of Jericho, don't we? The Israelites, did they march around it? Pardon?
Seven times.
Because the Israelite army was invading the land, and they were invading, and they were going to take Jericho. God had promised them Jericho, and God gave very clear instructions how to take Jericho. Before they did that, they sent in two spies, and the two spies entered Jericho. In spy-like gear. I don't know what that looked like. What's spy-like gear? I think it means tux, bow tie, suave, sophisticated, something like that. Box of chocolates, yeah. And they decided, now, this might be for the 18 version, but they decided to stay at the house of the prostitute. Rahab, the prostitute, took in these guys, and Jericho, the city at large, discovered that the spies were in the camp, so to speak, and they went searching for them. They came to Rahab's place and said, we've heard you've got these two guys. And she said, oh, no, they've gone. In fact, they hadn't gone. They were hiding in the slats of the roof above her head. Fantastic, isn't it? I don't know if they felt like ninjas at that point, you know, ready to drop at any point if they were to invade. And Rahab protected the spies, and the reason she protected the spies is because she said, I've heard about you lot, and I've realized, and everyone's terrified because God is doing something in you, and I just want you to know that I want to be part of it. Even though I'm a prostitute and I'm living in Jericho, which is the city of the big enemy, I'm actually in with you guys, really, and so I'm protecting you. Rahab is spoken positively in the New Testament. You remember the list in Hebrews 11, where there's great lists of men and women, as it turns out, of faith. Do you remember that list? And it talks about Abraham and David, all these wonderful men of faith. And in there as well is one lady, Rahab the prostitute. She had great faith, it says. In fact, she's mentioned again in James, where James is saying, never mind your fancy having faith. If your faith isn't worked out in practice, then you haven't got anything. And he says, and that, because who's the example that he shows up as a glowing example of this? He points to Rahab, the prostitute. He says, okay, her righteousness is demonstrated by her ability to trust beyond herself, beyond her circumstances, and to believe in the God who was coming. And as a result of her faith, it saved her. It's a great story, isn't it? Isn't that amazing that God chooses someone like Rahab to speak to each one of us of the wonders of faith? And God's saving grace for each one of us. And he incorporates her into his plan. So if Tamar is the one who is sidelined, who could potentially have felt sidelined in the purposes of God, rejected and dishonored, discarded, put to one side, Rahab is the one whose past could potentially disqualify her. The past of being a prostitute, whose life was not expected and morally was negative, but also her heritage. She's from the wrong nation. She's not from the people of God. She's from the enemy. And she could have easily have thought that that would disqualify her, couldn't she? But those things, her life, I'm just a prostitute in the enemy's land. But no, God says something different. That your past does not dictate your future. Feels like a phrase I've said before, but I want to say it again. Your past does not dictate your future. This last year does not dictate the future year that's coming. Because God is able to take someone like Rahab, who has decided to trust in the one who's coming, and completely change her purpose and her destiny in God. So much so that she's incorporated into the line of Jesus, the most important line, genealogy, that's dictated in the whole of the Bible. Rahab's in. Why? Because she decided not to let the past dictate her future and her possibilities in God. Tamar, the one who was sidelined, holds on to the promise. Rahab, the one whose past could disqualify her, but who presses on anyway and says, save me, and I'll work. My trust will be demonstrated in the fact that I'll do something. Are you with me? Tamar, Rahab. Ruth. Ruth was there was a couple called Naomi and I didn't write this down. Obineth, something like that. Anyway, we don't know much about him because he died quite quickly. So Naomi married, they're a Jewish couple, Israelite couple, and they had two sons, and there was a famine in Israel, and they went away. They went to find food, effectively, and they went into Moab, the enemy territory, and they got two wives, one for each son. That was the purpose of the two wives. And one of them was Ruth. Naomi's husband died, that's why I can't remember his name, and also her two sons died. And what was left with Naomi, the widow, with two daughters who were also widows, but they were daughters-in-law. And Naomi says she heard that back in Israel the food was back up, there were crops again, and she was returning. And she said to her daughters-in-law, she said, look, you're from this country. This is your home. My home's over there. Look, there's no obligation to me. You're free to go. And one of the daughters-in-law said, that's great, thanks very much, I'll stay, because this is my country. But Ruth didn't do that. Ruth said, no, I'm with you, Naomi. And he uses this phrase in the first chapter of Ruth. Ruth clung to her, to Naomi, and she said, your God is my God. Where you go, I go. Where you stay, I stay. I'm with you. And Naomi and Ruth went back to Israel, and in the end, Ruth ended up being married to Boaz, as it says in this genealogy, and God incorporated Ruth, the Moabitess, into the purposes of God. Who was Ruth? Ruth was the one who was cut adrift from her family. Ruth was the one who found her identity in Moab with all of her family, who left all of that behind. Ruth was the one who had a husband, but the husband died. She was lost. As she looked around her to her natural links, she had none. She was alone, with no purpose in this world, no links to other people, no father, no mother, no brothers and sisters, no husband, no kids. But she expressed something of the faithfulness of God in her love for Naomi, her mother-in-law. And she did it with joy. That's what you get as you read Ruth, this sense of utter commitment. There's no pain for her. But she was cut adrift. And as a result, she found herself incorporated into a new family. The family of God, where she found purpose, where she found companionship, where she found belonging, where she found an inheritance and a man who would be her kinsman redeemer. That's the phrase in Ruth. What does that mean? That she was taken from a place of lostness, of being cut adrift, and redeemed into purpose, into the family of God. And again, that's the genealogy, isn't it? The full family of God, from Jesus of Abraham to Abraham to Jesus. She's put right in the midst of that. We can disqualify, we could think maybe we're excluded because we feel cut off from family. We feel lost or alone in the world for some reason. God wants to say that he incorporates you into his family. And that family actually is more important than what was left behind, what was lost. And that is what Ruth experienced. She was favoured. And where before she had been unnoticed, she was noticed. Tamar, sidelined, rejected, dishonoured. But she held on to the promise and pushed for it in God. Rahab had a past that would disqualify her both from her moral life and from her family relationships. But she clung onto God and reached out for him to save her. She was a woman of faith, and her past did not disqualify her. Ruth was the one who was cut adrift from her natural family, but found through God part of the family. And the last one is Bathsheba. Here it describes her as Uriah's wife. Uriah was a Hittite. He was a Gentile as well. And so we assume Bathsheba was. And I think that's why Uriah is quoted here, in my opinion, is to emphasize the fact that he was a Gentile brought in. David was a king. When everyone else, all the kings should be out fighting, he was at home relaxing. And watching, as it turns out, and he looked across the rooftops and saw this beautiful lady, Bathsheba, and so he decided that this Bathsheba was going to be his. And through deceit and manipulation, he organized her to come over. He organized her husband Uriah to be killed at war. And he in the end, took Bathsheba as his wife. Bathsheba was abused by men, by powerful men. She was a victim. And David was the perpetrator. There's an amazing story, actually, as you read this in 1 Samuel or 2 Samuel, but in Samuel somewhere, 1 Samuel, of how God confronts David over his sin, and how David takes seriously God's challenge to him. This is the other side of this story. This story is not just about Bathsheba, the victim, but it's also about David, the perpetrator, the sinful man, the man who made a huge mistake, murderer and adulterer, and how God redeemed both of them into his purposes. Here's the thing with David. Even our mistakes do not exclude us from God's purposes, do they? Even our mistakes, God is able to redeem. And Bathsheba, the victim. It's actually a very modern story, this, isn't it? The powerful man abusing the woman. And it struck me how this is dealt with. And actually God's grace in the midst of this. And how God does not allow the victim or the perpetrator's purposes in God to be lost. Amazing. That's because of the way David responded, and I'm sure also the way that Bathsheba responded to it. But God is able to redeem even circumstances of abuse for his purposes. Bathsheba was a victim. Do you know what? Actually, I trust, you know, very, very few of us have experienced that kind of abuse. But the reality is that we can all feel victim in life, can't we? We can all feel like that circumstances are happening to us beyond our control. That things are happening that we neither asked for nor wanted in our life. And we can have the mentality of a victim. Oh, woe is me. This thing always happens to me. And we have an expectation of victimhood in our life. And it seems to me that Bathsheba did not allow that to take hold in her life. She did not live as a victim. The reason I say that is because later, part of this, what happened is that they gave, David and Bathsheba gave birth to Solomon. Solomon was the greatest of the kings of Israel, but it almost was lost because someone else declared themselves king. And Bathsheba said, no, you are not going to be king because we had a plan. And the plan is that Solomon will be king. And she fought for her son to be king. That is not a woman who's a victim. She was a victim, but she wasn't a victim in her mind. She was someone who was claiming her rights and the promises that have been put in her. And you know, in the things that happen in our life, we can feel victims. You know, there's lots of processes in life, particularly in recent experience with Maddie and with people in housing benefit and all that sort of thing. I can tell you that that can be a situation where you feel like a victim. The challenge to get the benefits to pay. I'm seeing some nods from Carol. There's one particular situation where to pay housing benefit, it took them 8 months to pay universal credit and housing benefit. Let me tell you, at that point, you feel like a victim. You are under circumstances that are beyond your control. But there's a difference between being in a situation you can't control and having a victim mentality. And actually, we can choose in the very ordinary situations that we have where we feel a victim, and that can be situations at work where people are doing things that are outside of your control that impacts you. It can be in your neighbourhood, and you know, it can be in family situations where you feel like a victim. But I believe God is, even though we might feel like circumstances are out of our control, we should not have a victim mentality. We have a mentality where we hold on to the promises of God, and we believe in the one who is above all of those things. We read that last week, didn't we? That God is above all. Jesus has been seated above every name, rule, and authority. And therefore, whatever name, rule, and authority is spoken into those victim situations, there is one who is higher than that. And God is calling us not to have a victim mentality. Because a victim mentality makes us think that we are excluded from the purposes of God. This always happens to me, and therefore I'm outside. Therefore I can't be used. God won't have me as part of his purposes. And it is possible that if we adopt a victim mentality that we will find ourselves there. But that is not God's purposes. God said to Bathsheba that you, even though you experienced something that was beyond your control and you were a victim, actually I'm taking you into my purposes and I am redeeming your life. Same as for Ruth, who was redeemed by Boaz. Bathsheba was redeemed by God. And God speaks into each one of our circumstances, I believe, and says, I am redeeming that. Redeeming means taking something that's bad and turning it into good because they fit into the purposes of God. And all through your life, God is redeeming you. Four women surprisingly find themselves in the list of the heritage of Jesus. Just four. Of all of the history. We know that there were many more women involved, don't we? But four of them were chosen. Four could have been excluded because they were Gentiles, because they were women. But other reasons as well, because they felt sidelined by the people around them, because their past didn't feel like it should be the past that would qualify them. That they feel lost. I'm going through the people now, you hear it. Tamar, Rahab, Ruth. They feel lost and disconnected from their heritage. Cut adrift. Bathsheba, the victim, and David, the perpetrator. All things that could feel like they are reasons to be excluded from the purposes of God, but God's grace and faithfulness to them incorporated them into his purposes, the biggest purpose that he could possibly have, the coming of Jesus. And I believe that God wants just to say to us this morning that whatever reasons you feel like you could be excluded, And maybe there's even one of those little headings there with those four women where you think, you know what, I've felt like that occasionally.